Welcome to another week at the Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, and I have with me in the studio today people who have been here before, once or twice. Candace,
hi,
founding
Lisa.
Editor of Boundless, coming up on your 10th anniversary.
Yes, woohoo!
How are you feeling about that?
Amazed and excited and thankful.
You have a couple more kids than you had then.
Four more. Well, okay. three and almost four.
Okay, yeah. Exactly. Mott Brown.
That's 10th anniversary of Boundless, not our wedding anniversary.
Right, okay.
That was last year.
10th anniversary of Boundless, mm-hmm. Okay. Mott Brown.
Hi, Lisa.
He is here.
All yes. Right.
Ready to, for a future show, we'll talk about more kids for him. Steve, same number of kids as Candace. Welcome, Steve.
What a coincidence.
Good thing.
We are pleased to report. And, okay, well, you want to stay tuned for this week's show. We will be talking with our panel again for the second half of our church panel. What were we calling that? Church dim sum, which people apparently on the blog thought we were going to talk about food, but you know, food and church or food and Chinese food. I don't know. But stay tuned for that. We will finish up that conversation, followed by an interview with the band Leland, who I think I may have been in high school or college when they were born, which is totally concerning. But we're going to give them some time here to talk about their latest project. Patrick Dunn is back with us for The Hungry Years, talking about identity. Hopefully his will not or has not been stolen. And finally, Candace and I are going to sit down and frankly tell a girl whether or not she's too fat.
So you don't want to miss it.
You don't want to miss it.
Stay tuned.
This is the equivalent of Yahoo Answers when people post their photos from Flickr and they're like, am I too fat? Am I hot? People think, eh. So this is the Boundless version of that. So you want to stay tuned. But we are just coming off of Patriots Day, which is now, is that an official holiday? If it's on a calendar, I guess it is.
I think so.
Otherwise known as September 11th, otherwise known as 9/11 or 9/11. And y'all remember where you were? Where were you?
Yeah, I do.
7 years ago, mm-hmm. FYI.
Wow. 2001. You know, wow. I was working for a national pregnancy center ministry in D.C. called CareNet. And I think somebody first saw it on online, saw the news item, the ticker or whatever. And we ran to our 12-inch TV and through static watched the burning tower. Mm. And watch the second tower be hit. So yeah, that's it's hard to forget.
Yeah, I was in the basement, pregnant with number two, and our firstborn was two. And my sister, actually, I was in the kitchen making breakfast. I remember, you know, the robe is pulled tightly around the great big belly, and she called and said, "Are you watching your TV?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Go turn your TV on." And I ran downstairs and just couldn't. It felt like a movie. I mean, it just felt surreal, and I think I watched TV almost all day and finally realized I probably ought to turn it off and engage with the two-year-old. And it was a really hard day, but I remember thinking that who's in leadership is so key, and just being thankful that we had strong leaders, because it was a really, really critical time for that kind of decision making.
You know, I was just hearing this week they were saying that we're still vulnerable, that we could still have a very similar attack any day, and that we have to stay diligent. And I think that's been a difficult thing for people to realize, is that even 7 years later, it is easy to have this sense of, well, nothing like that has happened again. That'll be a blip in history. But to realize that, you know, we still could have another destructive, disturbing kind of attack like that.
Yeah, I guess that's the good news, bad news of having an administration that keeps things like that from happening, because people go, well, there are no more threats. Nothing's happened. And we just don't know. We don't know what kinds of things go across the desks of the people making those decisions. And it kind of reminds me of the you know, the battle in the heavenlies that Paul wrote about in Ephesians, that there's so much more going on that we don't see.
Yeah. Well, I think you have to battle complacency. And that's what we're battling now, is kind of what you're saying, that it hasn't happened in 7 years. And you think that we're winning, and at least at our borders, that we're preventing it, and I think we are. I think the moment we sit back and think that it can't happen again, or it's probably dying off, it's when it's really the most dangerous.
I think the thing that caught a lot of people off guard, caught me off guard back then, was the sense of anybody who grew up in the Reagan years, like a lot of people on this show, we're used to this idea of these superpowers who are going after each other. And then all of a sudden it was that sense of some lone person or some group of 5-10 people can grab airplanes and run into buildings and do all these things that it's just not conventional warfare. It's not, you know, two powers clashing it out and in a real global scale as much as this idea of everybody's vulnerable to some lone terrorist who wants to do something crazy. And that really caught people off guard, especially the Cold War was over and there was this hope that maybe we are entering an era of long-term peace. And it was a reminder, not only was that peace ended, but it was a totally new kind of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and too, we were remembering that day all the worries about what else could happen. The sense of, okay, now they're worried about bridges. Now they're worried about
trains.
Yeah, or spores or some kind of biological
or
terrorism.
Or football stadiums.
Yeah, and there was that sense that all of a sudden it's not a way out there issue. This is a backyard issue. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm.
Well, they had that threat in Columbus, Ohio, where the mall, they actually found the plans of an attack on a mall being planned.
Yeah.
That was, and they were pretty close. That wasn't too long after.
And then the big question then that I think is still kind of a question now is how much do you clamp down? I mean, people were talking about, should we come up with millions and millions of dollars to secure all of our public facilities and bridges and all that? And you realize that's pretty crippling after a while. And there are a lot of things you can do to secure yourself and end up losing all these freedoms. And what's that balance look like? And then that's when you got all these reminders of one of the best things we can do is boldly, confidently live our lives even while we try to take some precautions and do things to defend ourselves.
And I think that brings up the point of not being afraid of the future, not being afraid of trusting that God's still sovereign and he's on the throne and we can still move forward in faithfulness to what he's called us to. I mean, being pregnant and seeing that news, there's no more vulnerable state than expecting a new life and feeling vulnerable yourself, but especially for this new innocent baby and thinking, what are we doing bringing little ones into this world? And again, even in this season, being pregnant again and thinking, the world's totally unpredictable. Mm-hmm. But just continuing to obey God's call to be fruitful and trust that he has good things in store and really seeing those babies as the hope for the future.
And I had a similar experience because my dad actually died a few days before 9/11. Mm. So it's always kind of a marker for me now in not only in history, but in our family. And he, so I was out in Minnesota and his funeral was 9/9. And then I was actually supposed to fly out, I think, on the 12th and ended up staying an extra 5 days. But, you know, all the talk just became, my dad was quite the greeter and quite the evangelist and stuff. And so everyone was like, he just needs to be up there to greet people. So people just start talking, you know, and stuff like that. So, but yeah, so 7 years ago. So it's quite but at the same time, we were kind of like in the wake of that. And then just a lot of the stuff that's gone on in the culture, we often reflect, you know, we're just glad that he's not here to deal with that. And it's just kind of like a good way of remembering or anticipating, I guess, you know, that we will be reunited with those folks, and history does march on. So, all right. Well, those of you who actually were in New York, it'd probably be pretty fascinating to hear from you. I know we have listeners in New York, so write to us, editor@boundless.org.
As well as Washington, D.C. and Pennsylvania.
Yeah, exactly. Some of the other spots that were affected. In addition to those of you who just remember that day, I actually went to the site just a couple of months afterwards. I was there on a work trip, and that was also very sobering just to see actually in Manhattan shafts of sunlight hitting the ground, you know, because that just doesn't happen, and it just kind of was a spotlight on that event and on that site. So, things to remember.
Time keeps moving on through the sunshine and the storm, and my dreams are set in stone. And someday I'll be who I wanna be. For now, I'll wait for the sun to shine again.
week's roundtable. We're going to continue the conversation with Suzanne Hadley and friends, Jared, Matt, Elisa, and Melissa, where we talk about churches. And I start off by giving a smackdown about church membership. All right, so now I'm going to step on some toes.
Sweet.
Because I am going to talk about, and I want us to talk about church membership. And the church that I'm at now is the first church I ever joined. I'm in my 30s, which is just pathetic. Despite the fact that every church I've ever attended had a membership program, I just never joined because I was either transient or I was too afraid for them to know anything about me. So I joined this one finally. It took me 5 years to join it, in part because my church, too, is Reformed. And I grew up probably in a more middle-of-the-road tradition as far as doctrine. So I had to bite the Reform bullet and decide to join. And I did, and my church is extremely hardcore about when you join the church, you're putting yourself under the authority of the church, you're actually buying into it as a community. You are to the point now where we're even thinking about addressing, you know, when you have conflict with another believer in the church, the elders in our church can get involved because you have, you know, like I said, put yourself under that authority. So I know, I think you, Jared, have joined your church. Your church has a standard membership program.
Yes.
Now, has anyone else officially joined their church? Or do you guys even have membership programs like the other?
I don't think there's a membership program at my church.
There's not one at mine.
Show up.
Okay. How do you guys feel about that? What do you think? Why do you think that is?
Well, obviously, I have a high opinion of church membership. I've written a couple articles about it. One of them was called Common Law Church, and it kind of made the association between just attending your church and being an acting member versus having the contract with your church, which really does give the administrators of your church more authority into your life, as you're saying. But the thing that I have found, there really are not a lot of churches that do membership anymore because I think they feel the younger generation isn't that interested in it, and they say, well, what's the big deal with a piece of paper, you know, making someone sign on? So I guess that would be the reason that I would say why churches aren't doing membership. They don't want to seem uptight or, you know, make it so formal, because nowadays people are so suspicious of anything where you have to sign your name and make a commitment, and I would say even me
like
included.
Marriage.
Yeah. I mean, think of all the junk mail we throw away every day just because it's like, there's no way I'm signing on to that. And I think people sort of have the same suspicion when it comes to church.
I think if you feel like you're not totally invested or not totally sure that's the church you want to go to, it's a scary thing to say, all right, I'm a member. I'm fully invested. I'm going to pour myself into this church and really make it happen. And so I think maybe that's a thing, like Suzanne said, that maybe scares people away because it does feel too, oh gosh, you've got a hold of me now. You know, and that's not a great mentality.
They're going to be checking the tithe rolls, you know,
right. Like, sending your envelopes to get the money. Yeah.
It is the commitment process, and especially with young adults in our generation, it's harder for us to commit, and whether it be to a church or marriage or whatever, it's just tougher for us to commit. We commit to like a Blockbuster membership, but you know, and it just feels like tying ourselves down to something like that. It's tough, and knowing that we don't have that freedom to say, well, I'm just going to go somewhere else this week or do something else. To say that you're a member just puts this obligation on you and says, you know, this is where I've committed to go, and the body of believers I've chosen to be a part of, and that's constricting to some people.
But this is Matt. I think it's really healthy for churches to have memberships because, I mean, a threat from the church is from the inside. And I think if they have a membership program, they can bring people in, get them on the same page, show them where they're going, and then they can be a part of it and get involved. And not that you're weeding people out, but you're just trying to bring them alongside your goals and aims. And I think that's healthy because, again, the threat is usually from the inside, those wolves in sheep's clothing. So I've never been a member, honestly, except for the one I was born into. So that's a freebie. But I think
that one is so expired right now. We need to move on.
I can see from the church's perspective, I don't understand why they wouldn't want to have membership. Because you want to know who is coming, who's attending, who can you get alongside, who are the people that you need to support and serve, and how can they form groups within that, you know, community groups or whatnot. So I don't, you know, looking at it logistically, mm-hmm. it seems like they would want to have membership just for that simple mm-hmm. fact.
And let's say you have some problems in the church, like there's sexual morality. And what do you do with non-members? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can talk to them, but if they're a member, you can hold them accountable
right.
and you can really provide mm-hmm. that godly discipline in their lives. But with non-members, I think it's more difficult to hold them accountable because they're just going to leave.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's why this church that I'm at now is the first time I've ever seen anyone brought up before the church for church discipline. Like it's mm-hmm. I mean, they're very mm-hmm. serious about it. Like if they bring in other people and the elders and try to mm-hmm. reconcile this person, say to a spouse because of infidelity and then bring them back into the fellowship and that person refuses, they do announce to the church that this person has been separated from the mm-hmm. fellowship because, I mean, it's just a biblical process that I think doesn't happen much. And I was so comfortable joining the church just because basically to be a member of the church, you have to be a Bible believing follower of Jesus Christ who, you know, trusts in, you know, salvation by grace through faith alone. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be a 5-point Calvinist. You don't have to believe in infant baptism, you know, the other things that are kind of part and parcel of my church. So I think that in itself is freeing. But I mean, I'm a big fan, especially because of, like with singles, we tend to want to pull away. We tend to, if you don't, you know, you can kind of come in and out. When you want that mm-hmm. fellowship or you want that accountability, then you kind of like scuttle on in. And then if you don't want it, you just scuttle on out and you don't have. So I think it's just, it's kind of dicey. What would you guys say about the whole role of like tithing in the church? Do you think that's just like old school? I mean, churches
absolutely
just
not.
No.
No way.
So churches shouldn't just, you know, get their money off of the coffee bar?
Or, no. I mean,
okay, this is Elisa.
For me, yeah, for me personally, when I don't know how else to say it except for it's not like I'm being blessed financially, but supernaturally, spiritually, when I'm tithing and I'm consistent and I'm saying, I'm trusting you with this money. And even if, you know, I may not back everything the church spends the money on, I'm trusting God with it. And it says a lot about my relationship with him more so than even with my church. And it just, it is giving your church the benefit of the doubt and saying, you know what, I'm trusting you with my money. And it saying it's my money, it's really God's money anyway. So to me, tithing is the utmost of importance. And like I said, just the... And I, whenever I am tithing, I definitely don't worry about my finances as much. I seem to have more money and I get more blessings just in other ways. So it's definitely not a thing of the past. And I mean, that's their job. And, you know, pastors need to get paid and the church has to function and have a building. And since we do live in a winter climate, we kind of need one. Can't be outside all the time.
You need to heat that building.
Yeah.
It's true. For me, tithing, I think about if you're in your church and you're not satisfied with the experience there, you should look at whether you're tithing to that church, because the verse that in Matthew that says where your treasure is, your heart will be also, I've found that to be very true. If you are investing in your church, you're going to care a lot more about the ministries of your church and what's going on there. So I think, and I agree with Elisa, that I feel that it has more to do with my relationship with the Lord and trusting him with the first of the resources that he's entrusted me with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyone else?
I think there's a lot of agreement at this table, but I think statistically only 4% of Christians actually tithe, according to some research. And yeah, it gives me a lot of joy to tithe. And I don't actually try to go for 10%. It doesn't say anywhere in the New Testament 10%, so I just try to give as much as I can within reason. And yeah, it's just much more fulfilling. And like Suzanne was saying, those who tithe are usually like the elders or those who are involved, who are doing ministry, and it's just good to be a part of that.
Well, I think a lot of people look at tithing and say, well, I'm not just giving to the church, or maybe I'm not giving to my church at all, but I'm sponsoring a child, or I'm sponsoring missionaries or others. So there's so many, I don't want to say parachurch, maybe parachurch activities that people are giving money to that they don't necessarily feel like they're tithing to the church. And some churches, you know, well, I should say often, will preach about giving money and financial support, but then they also say, don't feel obligated to give here, but we want you to give somewhere. So that, I've been hearing that more in the last few years. So I think a lot of people feel like, okay, I don't have to give 10% to the church, but I'm giving other places. So I don't know how that affects churches, but I'm sure, like Elisa said, that it's difficult then for them to function if they're not, don't have guaranteed money coming in. Or
sure. Okay. So Colorado Springs is considered, you know, we'd be considered kind of a Christian mecca. We have well over 100 ministries here, a ton of churches. But I think sometimes there's a perception, even within our own community, that our churches don't really work too well together, you know, as far as unifying on behalf of the community to reach our community and to reach the West here where we are. What do you think that we could do better as churches, you know, from the mega churches to the small denominational churches and beyond, to kind of unify in a better way?
Something that I really appreciate that my church does is each week we pray for another church in the community at the beginning of service. And it's usually a really detailed type of prayer, you know, just that God would really work in their ministry, because we recognize that not everyone is going to come to our church, not everyone should come to our church, and there are these functioning bodies all over the city, and so it's really edifying to pray for those other ministries and pray that, you know, God would be blessing them as well.
I think this is Jared, and I think specifics on how to unify churches, it's a hard concept for me to grasp and to kind of unite all of the believers in Colorado Springs together would just be nearly impossible in a way of how we can perceive it just in our human state. And so I like some of the ideas that it is nice when churches do kind of reach across and work together in areas or pray for each other. But to me, it sometimes just seems too kind of far-fetched and out there to somehow get all of the churches together in this harmonious way and working together to reach the town. And so in a way, I'm a little content to just say, you know, our church will reach our neighborhood and do what we can here and there. Trying to partnering with church is, I'm not against it, but it's just, sometimes it's might be missing the focus.
I guess I have thoughts to go back. I went on a missions trip to China, and Jared was on that as well. And when you go to another country, or at least when we were in China and the church is so oppressed there, it seems like it just strips everything down to the basics of the gospel and Jesus Christ. And then coming back here, there is a market mentality to church. And that's why there's so many offshoots. That's why there's so many churches here, because they have a little bit different style of worship and a little bit different style of church and a little bit different people at other churches. And so they're separate for a reason. And so I don't know how to bring them together either.
I think one of the ways to bring them together is to find the needs of the city. And if they could gain some momentum, traction around a need, I think they would work together. Because trying to force churches together just to have potlucks or do some barbecues or have like a interfaith church meeting,
it really just feels...
It feels forced. It's done maybe once a year, and I don't think there's a lot of benefit. So I think the benefit will come when the needs are in the center and people can and work on those together.
There needs to be a common vision that is a passion that they can work toward. Just like any amazing any organization, you know, you have to have a common vision and say, let's work toward that, rather than little potlucks and... It doesn't seem real. I think that's what I'm seeking, is what's real and what's true.
And necessarily the benefit of that. I mean, that's it's almost the vision of what will look like, in heaven and beyond, when we actually will be united and connected. And that's almost an option that's not available to us in our earthly human state.
Well, and yet understanding that there are distinctives. I mean, even when every tribe and every tongue and nation worships God in heaven, they will have been created for his glory with distinctives. And I think that's how the body of believers is too. Like Jared was saying, churches need to realize that they do have distinctives within a greater vision.
So there will be at least some people in heaven who had not even yet heard Shine Jesus Shine. They will be that far even behind my own church. Yeah. So maybe Graham Kendrick can lead everyone in that when we get up there and just teach it to those who do not yet know it. So
I want to add something more to that, to talking about churches uniting. It's just like, you know, when you think of the body, everybody has their own skill their own niche. And so if that can be brought together in kind of a harmonious, you know, goal, then I think it could work. But I don't know how to do that. It sounds a little high and lofty, but
sure. Yeah, this is Elisa. I think what I've seen around here is churches pairing with parachurch ministries like Compassion or other organizations like that. And that seems to work better than church to church. And I'm not sure exactly why that is. Maybe they're not equally threatened by each other or something to that effect. But I think, and I've seen this back home, where one or two churches will get together on a specific cause. And I've seen that work well. The pastors are friends, and, you know, perhaps they even knew each other. They went to seminary together, and they, you know, although they have very distinct churches, they can still have a common community goal that they both reach out on. So maybe it's not 18 churches. Maybe it's one or two or three getting together in groups within the church. I've seen that work better than trying to have a huge, you know,
I think we have mess. A uniqueness atmosphere here in Colorado Springs, being the Christian Mecca, and that you have this round table here, which five different churches represented, and you know, we're all really good friends of Suzanne. And so it's easy in this town. It may be more difficult in other towns, but it's easy to find people that are involved in other church bodies. And that's a simple way of connecting those churches together, you know, knowing that you can be friends and socialize and interact with people that don't go to your church, and respect them and know that they're getting fed, and opening yourselves up to them as well and being fed from them, from someone from another church body.
Well, this has been great, you guys. This has been very helpful. I think I've determined after talking to these folks that they all are believers. So that's good. I wasn't, you know, wasn't sure coming into it, but, and we have sufficiently rebuked most of them for not having membership programs in their church. So they're all going to go back and start that. Jared and I will follow up with them and make sure that in fact,
lay down
does
the hammer.
Happen. Oh no, Matt's does too. He has a membership program in his church. So that's good. But anyway, well, this has been a fascinating conversation. This has been great. So I think just in encouraging our listeners, I think everyone here would say, you know, find a church. Don't just be drifting around. I mean, goodness gracious, it's not something that you do when you're married and have kids. Find a church, get invested in it, get involved in it. Pick it as a community, as a family, and then stick with it just like you would. I mean, there are reasons. You're going to have your ups, you're going to have your downs, you're going to have your church envy, you're going to have your church snobbery, you're going to have everything. Go to boundless.org for articles on the church. You can find blogs, posts on the line. Obviously, we've talked a lot about this on Boundless. I would also recommend 9marks.org. You've heard us talk about Mark Dever out at Capitol Hill Baptist in Washington, D.C. That is the number 9marks.org. Just for finding a great church in your area. And, you know, I mean, just hello, as Lisa A. would say, stop messing around, people, and get the job done. So it is a biblical mandate to be part of a Bible-believing community, and one in which you can grow and serve and ultimately represent the glory of God right where you are and be his ambassador. So
I'd back that up, Lisa, and just say that, you know, a lot of times, especially with the young adults, we just feel like we keep looking for that perfect church. And we kind of suffer from this entitlement mentality of like, I need this pastor, I need this type of music, I need this program. And I like what you said, just get out there and find that church. And when you find it, stick with it. And if you're expecting that church never to change, that's an unrealistic expectation. Stick with it. And especially if you sign up, you're part of that church. So it's really an extension of you and your family that's going through this change. And stay with it.
And as has been said before, if you find the perfect church, the minute you show up, it won't be.
Living in the same town for all these years, doing the same old things, hanging with the same crowd, and it's starting to get crippling. You never fail to place, and you tell yourself it's all okay, but something's different today. You want to run the opposite way.
studio today for this week's culture segment. I have four of the five members of the band Leland. They have chosen to visit us here in Colorado Springs, which is excellent. And so we are going to be talking to Leland, Mike, Jake, and Jack today about their upcoming, or their current project, I guess. Their album is called The Opposite Way. I actually first met them at Gospel Music Week, I think a couple years ago, and it was fun to kind of get to know them then, and here they are back with us again today, visiting, which is very exciting. So the first thing that we have to talk about is the fact that I found out all of you guys are married, and I think you're all like 7 years old, so that is crazy, and I need to know really what the whole story is behind that.
I started things off about a year and a half ago, and everybody just caught the bug, man.
We wanted to be like Mike.
It's in the water. I think it's in the water that we drink or something in Baytown. So, I don't know.
We just got lucky and found really great ladies early on.
Good, yeah. Good answer.
So tell me how you guys actually met your wives.
Me first?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, cool. I met my wife probably, actually 6 years ago. And she went to our church, knew her for a long time. We actually started working together for my brother. He had a telemarketing company that actually all of us worked at one point to pay the bills because we didn't have any shows to play. So we're all working for him, and she was working for him, and we were actually put in the same room, a cubicle across from my cubicle, actually.
Was there like some cubicle flirting?
There was some cubicle flirting, you know. So, yeah, I'd find really dumb reasons to go, you know, over to her cubicle and ask for like a pen or a pencil or something like that, you know. Well, just kind of going through church and getting to know her at work and stuff like that, we ended up dating. And after 3 years of dating, we got engaged and then got married December 1st, so. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I think all of us met our wives pretty much through church or through some sort of ministry type of thing. I've known my wife for like 4 years. We met like at my parents' church. She was like 14 and I was like 15. And we were like friends for like 3 years, 2 or 3 years. And then I ended up dating her for a year and we got married. So it was really cool.
We actually spoke with one of the actors from Fireproof a couple weeks ago who also is planning to marry young. So something must be in the water. I want to hear your perspective. What have been really some of the benefits of marrying young for you guys, and then what are some of the challenges?
Well, I think, you know, our parents were all really supportive of us, you know, getting married at a young age. And, you know, I think God has a different plan for everybody. You know, it's not like a specific formula that everybody has to follow. But I think, you know, some of the great things about being married young is that, you know, it's an exciting time in your life, and, you know, I don't think you're ever really, really, you know, fully ready or know exactly what you're doing, you know? We're all just trying to figure it out.
We're all learning.
And it's like, you know, God, it's been incredible because God's just teaching us, you know, how to be a good husband, you know, at the age of 19 or the age of 24, and it's cool having to rely on God in that area, especially at this young age. It definitely requires you to grow up a little bit, you know?
I think, and also I think one of the main things is as far as ensuring, you know, a good marriage, our parents my mom and dad actually met when they were 19 and 18. And so, that's one of the ways where they were supported us getting together and stuff. And they're talking to me, they said, you know, you're never going to know everything, you know, and you're always going to be learning every day. But the main focus is just as long as you keep God in the center of your relationship, everything's going to fall into place. And so I think we've all kind of taken that role as in like, we're just, you know, we're all just, we don't know what we're doing, you know, but we're in it for the ride. And so we're putting God first in everything that we're doing, and God takes care of us. So, yeah.
And saying yes, ma'am, to everything works too.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, obviously you guys have evidenced a lot of intentionality in relationships, and it seems to me that that translates a bit into your music. And I'd like to talk about that. Just the fact that for a bunch of young guys who have a band, you seem to have really kind of found your identity as a band and have a pretty hardcore mission as to what you're hoping to accomplish. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, I mean, I think a lot of us knew what we wanted to do and knew what we wanted to do with music. And the cool thing about it is that God had wives for us that are totally supportive of that. And I think all these guys, you know, I mean, I think I can speak for all of them and say that all of our wives love what we're doing and they support us and are very happy, you know, and are right there beside us through the whole music thing. And so, I mean, as far as playing out practically, I think that It's really interesting. Like, I mean, my wife, I've known for my whole life and never thought that she was going to be my wife, like not even anything like that, you know. And God kind of turned it around one day, and it was kind of weird, you know. And
that's cool.
But yeah. I think that all these guys could say that, you know, that their wives are right next to them and definitely for what we're doing and for what we're doing in the kingdom.
Yeah, I think too, like when we first started as a band, before we were even signed, we started out leading worship at our home church. Me and my brother was a youth pastor, and I was kind of like helping leading worship. I was like 15, and Jake's my cousin, so we grew up together. We're like brothers pretty much. And Jake was playing bass in the youth band, and we met Mike through a friend of ours at IHOP and
Pancakes
Place, not the International House of Prayer.
less spiritual.
And we met him there, and we started leading worship every Thursday night at our church. And pretty much worship was all we knew. And you know, we would get on our face every day, you know, every night, and just praying that God would do something in the youth of our city, and they'd do something, and we'd lead worship, and we saw God do some amazing things there. And so when we start as a band, when we started writing music, and we're like, now we're going to start doing this for real, as it started playing outside shows.
We had to be really intentional.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. We're okay musicians, but you know, we're not incredible entertainers, you know. And so I think as we've come to a point where just like, you know, we need God in everything that we do. And so when we get up there, if the presence of God isn't with us, then you know, it's like it all kind of fails.
Because I can't just go on the shredding keyboard solo and impress everybody, you know what I mean? The God has to really do the impressing, or we're not in a very good place.
Yeah.
We know there are a lot of strong opinions out there on worship, and we've talked about that on the show, even with some other artists. What is your take on worship? And as part of that, maybe tackle how you personally would craft a worship song.
Yeah,
I think worship to me and to us as a band, more than just music and a time at church, is your life in general, how you live your life, your actions, your relationship with Christ. Everything you do should glorify and worship and point to God. So I think for us, worship has become more of a lifestyle. And I think that's kind of what has kind of solidified our message and our heart as a band, is because we all kind of grew up, you know, Jack and Leland's dad and Jake's mom are all in the ministry and pastors. My dad's a pastor. Matt grew up in ministry and things like that. So, you know, from a young age, our parents kind of instilled that value in us of that worship is a lifestyle. It's not just, you know, 30 minutes Sunday morning at church or Wednesday night. It's Monday, you know, Sunday through Saturday, 24 hours a day, everything you do pointing to God and your relationship with God.
Yeah.
And that's so much harder than just singing a song. Gosh, man, you know, I'll sing a song any day, you know what I mean? Yeah. But it's to actually live that, you know what I mean? It's that's the Christian walk.
You know, a lot of us, well, for the first record, Sound of Melodies, all the songs are written out of our home church, and were written out of those times of worship with our youth group and stuff. And songs like Tears of the Saints that are on the CD, that which is one of my favorite from the first one. And that song was actually written, a lot of the songs are kind of written like this. That one was written after Sunday morning at one of our services. I came back home. And I just felt a real big urge to like really pray, like, and seek God for some weird reason. Like, it was like super strong, and I hadn't had like that before. And so I went into the room and I just started worshiping and started singing old hymns on the piano. And while I was doing it, God just started reminding me of all these, all my friends and people that I knew that were really far away from God. And I just started feeling God's grief, and I started like kind of weeping in the room by myself. And then I just, out of that weeping, and while I was crying, I just started singing that melody, "There are tears in the saints for the lost and the saved," and that just kind of came there. And so a lot of the songs are kind of written out of experiences like that, or hearing something, or just out of prayer and intimacy with God. And then there's a lot of fun songs too on the record that were just written, you know, in the living room, you know, with getting a melody after you wake up in the morning or something, you know. And so it's just really cool. And a lot of the times we wouldn't even mean to write a song when we come into practice. We just worship together. At the beginnings of our band, we would come together, and there were points where we didn't even want to write. We didn't want to play around. We just worship. And if we had a song we'd already written, we'd just flow on that and worship for about hours and just worship together in a funeral home. A funeral parlor is what we practiced in. And so we'd do that for hours, and God would just show up, and we'd just get so encouraged by God's presence being there. And that's, yeah.
Are there any particular bands out there, specifically ones who are secular, that you have a burden for as a band yourself? And if you had influence over, or you could speak into their lives, or you could sit down and chat with, you know, what would that look like? How do you feel about that?
That's a good question.
We could probably give you probably, you know, 50 answers to that one. Some of our favorite bands are bands like Coldplay and stuff like that. And, you know, it'd be really, really cool to see those guys. I don't know what their spiritual walks are at all, but, you know, to see them guys just totally on fire for God. And I'd love to go in a worship service with Chris Martin being the worship leader. That wouldn't be that bad.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty nice.
I would love to be in a worship service with Sigur Rós.
Yeah.
I went to one of the, well, this is interesting because it just shows that God has a call on people's lives to do things and to do incredible things. Even if they're not saved or not, you know, I'm not sure the spiritual, you know, thing with Sigur Rós and how they are, but I walked there on a live show in Houston and there are people literally in tears from the music, just from how beautiful the music is. They sing in a different language so you can't even understand them. It's just the music is what you listen to. And it sounded so heavenly and so awesome, these ideas and the melodies. And I was just thinking, man, I couldn't imagine if all those guys were just on fire for God and were just completely saved, what God could download into them, you know, after that, like how much better it could even be, you know, and the anointing that would increase on it, you know, when they played and what would happen, you know. And so it's so exciting to see that. And, you know, we pray, we have a lot of bands like that we just pray over, you know, constantly in our personal time, just God, give us a chance to minister to those people, you know, because they have greater influence than we do. And what a great thing they'd do if they were saved, you know. And so,
well, it's been great having you guys here in the studio today. Thank you so much for your time. You can always find more information on Leland at lelandonline.com or just go to boundless.org for more information, and we will keep you up to date. Patrick Dunn on this week's edition of The Hungry Years. He does his best to tell us as he tackles the issue of identity.
Who am I? It's a question maybe you've struggled with. And sure, you can wonder, who am I, after your second all-nighter during finals? And I've stared at that animal in the mirror. Who am I? Usually after my 12th chocolate chip cookie. But I'm not talking about these moments when we question our identity. Or the times like when your college roommate was crowned keg warrior and woke up the next morning wondering who and where he was. This is about your identity. What makes you tick? I remember my breakthrough moment. The first time I ever read about personality types, descriptions and characteristics leapt off the page. This is me! I can't believe it! This is why I get depressed watching the Nature Channel! And now I understand my fear of spreadsheets and my longing to be a Viking. Maybe you're searching too. The epiphany of self-discovery can unlock so many mysteries. Unfortunately, it can create some too. I mean, there I was, in a sea of sanguines and cholerics. I was a melancholy phlegmatic, or a melphleg if you're in the know. I was uncovering the complexities of family of origin issues, strengths and weaknesses, and a clearer vision of, who am I? Until I found more questions and more personality tests. Wait, am I an otter? A golden retriever? A lion? Which animal am I? Oh, look, the DISC test. I thought I was kind of an influencer, but steadiness? And what about conscientiousness? I care, right? Then Myers-Briggs came along with its I's, J's, T's, and E's. Now I'm nothing but a bunch of letters. Hey, what's up? I'm ENFJ. Tell me a little about your vowel and consonant combination. Oh, and birth order? Look at all these similarities I have with the youngest child. Hey, my big brother was anal retentive after all. That's how they are. So much information. Now, which me am I? And if I'm an E, can I date an I? What happens when two N's are in the same room? Life began to turn into one big word problem. Which movie would you rent in a room with an otter, a D, three J's, a golden retriever, and a sanguine? By the way, if you're a phlegmatic, you wouldn't rent anything. You'd ask someone else to, or one of the D's would take over, and you'd be fine with that. The more I learned, the more I felt mired in personality gridlock. Each new test or book brought affirming strengths and who God had designed me to be. But so many weaknesses to be praying about, and which one do I tackle first? It's a slippery slope that can lead to words like codependency and phrases like love hunger. And now you've done it. You're officially trapped in the self-help aisle of the bookstore. By the time you get out, you're convinced that you're an enabling, fear-driven, mask-wearing, perfectionist adult child of alcoholic, divorced, latchkey parents unable to see that happiness is a choice, battling obsessive, controlling, manipulative behavior rooted in trapped anger and anxiety from phantom guilt and childhood lies, probably due to bullying, weight issues, even if you didn't have any, and possibly that time when you were two and that bunny ate your favorite shoelaces, and how are you going to heal from that? Honestly, one of the greatest things God ever led me to was some of these tools and the desire to learn about who I was and who He made me. But I really did reach a point where I felt overwhelmed by weaknesses, by pain from my past. I saw things almost too clearly, that there was so much for me to overcome, how to handle relationships better, to grow into a biblical idea of manhood, you name it. I was sinking in, who am I? Until God began to change my focus onto who He was and who I am through Him and who I can be because of that. Hey, it's fun to be a golden retriever, moderate E, male phleg, and FP, but the biggest discovery I ever learned is what God can do with a simple prayer. I'm yours. Mold me and make me.
Opening up this week's inbox, we have quite the question this week. This is probably, I have Candace in the studio with me, and this is probably one of those questions that like every female wants to ask.
That's
but right. Doesn't.
Nobody's brave enough.
Oh, but one of our listeners did, bless her heart. So we are going to tackle it head on, aren't we, Candace?
We are, Lisa. Let's just plow straight ahead.
And I'm just going to say...
Oh, wait, let me grab another donut.
I already ate a donut in celebration of this question. It was a chocolate-covered one that Candace brought in. Yeah. Thank you for that.
In honor of these
questions. Put me in the correct frame of mind. So she says, Candace... here we go. She says, I am 27 and I have a desire to marry... But I am not married, and I need to know, is it me? Is it the fact that I am not thin? You see, I believe I am a catch. God loves me. I love Him. We talk. We interact. Our relationship ebbs and flows. But I am convinced that there is nothing sweeter than relationship with Him. In addition, I attend a great church where I am active working and serving there in many ways. I have a good job. I have a normal family. I also have good fashion sense. I have fun friends who are all in relationships, and that makes my life even better. I am pretty loud. I'm not the sweet kindergarten teacher that my best friend is. I laugh loudly and I tend to tell people what I think about things when they ask. I also can let some anxiety get in the way of having a good time if I'm leading an activity or an event. I mean, can't we all list the things that we know are our weaknesses? So I will let this be it. So ladies and gentlemen, is it me?
So, no, wait a minute. Did she say, oh, I'm not, she says I'm not thin.
Right.
Okay. And for those of you listening, what's her name? Do we have a name?
Her name is Stephanie, I
think. Stephanie did send a picture, mm-hmm. Which I thought was very brave. Stephanie, you are a brave woman, and I just want to applaud you for asking the question and being willing to say, not only am I too fat, but look at me, am I too fat? The good news is that all types get married. If you sit in a mall or you sit at a park or you sit anywhere where there are lots of people, you will see couples of all shapes and sizes walking hand in hand with wedding rings. And I know from looking at the bridal announcements in the newspaper that they didn't all start out size 2 and then balloon the first year of marriage, mm-hmm. because they could finally eat what they wanted to. So you don't need to be fearful that your body type will preclude you from getting married. That's the encouraging first point. And actually, when Steve and I met, I was probably 35 pounds heavier than when we got married. And we started dating right around the time that I started getting serious about getting in shape. And it was a real comfort to me that he was attracted to me and took me on as girlfriend before I got thin, because I didn't want to have that doubt in my mind that, oh, did he start liking me just because, you know, I dropped 3 dress sizes? And so it meant so much to me that he really fell in love with who I was as a person. And that has meant the world as I've gone up and down in my weight, having babies and losing weight and, you know, all the changes that come physically through motherhood. And so I would say that you want a guy who is not fixated on weight. Okay. However, men are visual. And while I do believe that all sizes get married, I think in this day and age when marriage is harder to come by, you probably have a better fighting chance if you are not obese. And if you are not, and Stephanie, you're not obese. I saw the picture. But I think you know that you could stand to drop a few LBs and maybe a dress size or two. And a lot of our listeners, you know, can probably relate to that.
In a healthy way, of course.
In a healthy way. And that's what I want to focus on. It's about fitness and health. And it's about having a mindset of, I want to be the best steward of the body God gave me. And that includes doing what you can with fashion today and making the most of what you look like right this minute. But it also means getting active today so that tomorrow you're on the path toward wellness. And I think that attitude will be attractive to a man, because a man, most men don't want women who are fixated on their weight, but they want women who are paying attention to it enough to be healthy.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's true, Candace. I think that there is, it kind of cuts both ways in that I know guys who have had very unhealthy attitudes and very pie in the sky attitudes about women, you know, based on, of course, the standard, what we all say, what they see in the media and whatnot. And, you know, had some of my friends date guys or meet guys who just flat out told them, you know, I don't, well, one was actually told, you know, I just never thought that I would marry someone who's overweight. And so he just wrote her off. But on the other hand, I think that there are many women out there who just say, well, you know, if he doesn't love me for who I am, then this and that, and that's inappropriate as well. I mean, because right. There is, you know, there is an objective meaning to being fat, and most people know what it is, and yeah. You know, and whatever you want to euphemize it as, overweight or whatever, people know whether they're healthy or whether they're not. And I think women in turn need to kind of get a grasp on reality where that's concerned and do what is necessary to move on that path towards, you know, being healthy.
Well, and I've found for myself that I know when I'm being fit in my habits and also in my mindset, and I know when I'm using food as more than fuel. Mm-hmm. You know, when food becomes the comfort in the midst of depression, and then it's so easy to fall into when you're not dating and you wish you were, and you get into that cycle of, oh, I'm too fat, no one will like me, I better go get some Ben and Jerry's because then I'll feel better, and then you feel guilty for eating the Ben and Jerry's, and then, you know, it's just this relentless cycle, and it's depressing. And I think that sends out a message that you're not comfortable or confident in your own skin. And if you can flip that switch and get to the point of, you know what, nothing I do today will change how I look today, but what I do today can change how I look tomorrow. And you just start making healthy choices and just really try to, through prayer and through you know, getting the information you need, start to make wise, healthy decisions and use the fuel that God gave. Enjoy food. Don't be weird about it, you know, but stop eating when you're not hungry anymore and mm-hmm. get out and go for a walk. And there are very simple things you can do. You don't have to have expensive exercise equipment or have an expensive gym membership. And I think even before you start to drop dramatic amounts of weight, your attitude will change and that will attract the opposite sex. Mm-hmm. And you, again, you do have to remember that men are visual, and so how you look matters. But it shouldn't, you shouldn't go after a guy who is so fixated on your looks that he says, well, if you ever get down to a size 6, call me, because then I'd be interested. That's, right. you know, not for the makings of a good relationship.
Right. Well, and I think there's good news, too, in the fact that, don't you think there's you know, some camaraderie here, or a sense of camaraderie, because most women out there will tell you that they have some issue with their body in some sense. So it's not, I think
Definitely.
We tend to play the comparing game too yeah. much and think, you know, well, she is at least 10 pounds lighter than I am. So everyone, you know, I'm sure will be attracted to her and not me or
well,
whatever.
Well, she may not have a good personality. I mean, she might be, you know, snippy or something. I've never met any woman who's happy with her body, and that's a problem with our hearts. We need to be thankful for who God made us to be and pray for contentment in that area. That's a good mm-hmm. area to pray for contentment. But really, kudos.
I tend to just assume that everyone who really is that thin and that good looking has a bad personality.
Exactly.
And that has helped me immensely throughout
or
the years.
Or they cackle or
so
something's got to be
that.
Wrong. They don't have a good laugh. I don't know. But kudos to Stephanie, because this is a painful question to ask. And, you know, it's like saying, do I have halitosis? I mean, there are some things you never want to bring up, but sometimes you need to, because, yeah, if you need a little help, if you're having trouble getting away from food as comfort or away from food as more than what God made it to be, get someone who can help you in this area and encourage you and try to, you know, get the focus off of that and into a healthy lifestyle.
Okay, I'm sure this is a hot button for all of you, so we definitely want your feedback on it. Write to us at editor@boundless.org, or if you just have something brief to say, you can call us at 1-866-687-8686 and let us know your thoughts. Guys, we want to hear from you, too. We will try not to judge you, but no, we want to know both sides of the story. Get your opinions, and women out there, if this is something that you have encountered, struggled with, had victory over, we want to hear that too. So I'm sure we'll get quite the discussion going where this is concerned. So we will dig up more questions like this in the future, I'm sure. Of course, we can't unless you send them to us. So please do that. Again, our email box is editor@boundless.org. Send us all your feedback, and we will do our best to address it. So until next week, as we head into fall, have a great week. Those of you who are running to this podcast, that is fantastic. Way to be healthy. Those of you who are just sit and eat while you listen to it, we're supporting you too. That's good.
Just listen.
So, just listen and tell your friends. So we will see you around next time.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.